Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another Motorsport Magazine podcast, and boy, we've got a good one for you today on a beautiful spring morning in London overlooking the River Thames. Summer is here, well, nearly anyway. Our guest today has 5 decades in motor racing. Can you imagine that? He really has. He's been in motor racing for 5 decades, and he comes from a little part of the south coast of England that used to be the sort of epicentre of international motor racing. Let me give you a few examples. David Purley, John Watson, Derek Bell, Church Farm Racing, Lek Refrigeration Formula One. I mean, you know, the land between Bognor Regis and Littlehampton produced some fantastic talent. Did it not? Mike Earle, welcome to our podcast.
First of all, thanks for having me. I assume you couldn't get anybody famous.
We couldn't. No, we couldn't.
So I'm here. Yeah, it was pretty special. I always figured it was because none of us could get a proper job. So, but yeah, it was a great time. And I obviously worked with all of those guys one way or the other. I mean, John, for instance, asked if he could rent a room for a night and stayed 4 years.
Did he pay the rent?
Oh yeah, yeah, slowly. That went right through his time when he sort of just was in Formula 2.
Yeah.
He came to us at that time, right up until the time he earned enough money to buy his own flat, which was 100 metres down the road. So we still fed him. But yeah, and Purley, obviously, that was something special.
Yeah.
It was a special time. I always swore, and he actually agreed with me, that he only ever had his own race team because it was an extension of his army life, and it was his own little team. It was his own platoon. And that's the way he used to tackle it. He had no real interest in motorsport.
No.
He didn't know anything about motor racing. he, you know, he just really didn't. He didn't bother to read magazines, didn't care what people thought about him. He just loved motor racing. We took him testing one day at Goodwood, and it was the first time we'd run skirts on a car. And he got to the end of the pit road, stopped, came back, and he said, car's broken into, it's dragging on the ground. We said, David, these cars have got skirts. You're going to get that. Oh, right, okay, fine. He hated testing. We took him to, after he'd had his big shunt at Silverstone, we arranged a sort of very private test day with the second car at Goodwood. And he said, what did I do here before? So we told him the time and he said, right, okay, fine. So I've got to find out if I'm still good enough. Yeah, that's it, David. Well, about the third lap, he did what he'd done before. And we showed him the board and he braked at the end. We had the place to ourselves. He braked, got to the end of the pit road and drove the wrong way down the pit road and said, well, that's it then, isn't it? I said, well, you'll do some more running and, you know, no, that's it. I'm okay. He only wanted to race. He was quite remarkable. Of course, Derek was through the Formula, well, the earliest really, was about 65, 66 with Derek. I went along sort of and helped as a gopher, really. And then it gradually grew until Derek went off to Ferrari. And then old Colonel Hinder asked me if I'd run the team when we got the M10A from McLaren for Getting. So, but yeah, Derek was special. Derek was the guy at the right place at the wrong time.
Sure, I mean, all three, you know, John Watson, Derek Bell, David Purley, all three had talent, didn't they? I mean, they had real. They were quite special guys in their own different ways, weren't they? I mean, Derek with sports cars, John, you know, had some great Grand Prix, and David on his day was a fantastic driver, wasn't he?
David was talented. He wasn't a top line driver. No. I mean, being honest, he wasn't. If you gave him a good car, yeah, he'd wring its neck. But if the car wasn't good, he didn't have the discipline to drive around the problem or try and help you get over the problem. Yeah. He would just accept the fact that he wasn't going quick. Watty, for instance, a different beast altogether. He was incredibly smooth. But, you know, if this car had an ounce of understeer in it, he'd rather be making coffee at home, to be honest. But he was phenomenal. And, you know, when he lost the championship, finished second, that was all down to his shunt at Monza, I think. If he hadn't had that, he'd won the championship.
Yeah.
Tremendous driver.
Pearlie was unbelievably brave, though, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
I mean, and he used to... I mean, the thing I've never forgotten, he told me once about the first turn, the first right downhill right-hander at Rouen, that he used to scream into his helmet as he was turning into it.
Yeah.
And he said, because that's exactly what we used to do in Aden, you know, going over the top. So when you were saying about the extension of his army life, that makes absolute sense.
And I think the fact he won the Chimay road race in Belgium, was it 3 years on the trot? I mean, you know, that was a place for the... Yeah, for the committed, wasn't it?
Yeah,
we
figured that they should have given the place to him. He'd won it that many times, but he was. He was ridiculously brave. But he wasn't a fool. He didn't do daft things. But he was ridiculously brave. I mean, unfortunately, the thing that killed him was an extension of that, because once he'd packed up, he bought two Pitts aerobatic aircraft. One for him, one for a friend, and they shipped them back from the States. And our workshop in those days used to be on the airfield at Leck Refrigeration. And he hired an old boy who was pretty doddery to put them together. And the old boy used to come up and say, "Have you got a spanner? Got any of those plastic things? What tie things together?" I went, "Oh, fine, yeah. And I said to Pearls, "Hey, you sure about this bloke?" "Oh, yeah, he knows the job. He's no problem." And anyway, he fetched somebody down from the Philip Morris aerobatic team to fly it first. And the guy said, "Who built it?" And he showed him. He said, "I'm not flying it." And Pearls just jumped in it, took it off, and stood it on its tail. And that was it. Then he decided he didn't know how to land it, because the nose was so long. if you weren't careful, the prop was huge, given its performance, it would dig in the ground. And he went round about, I don't know, 50 times before he realised if he kicked it sideways, he could then see and then just drop it in. That's the way he was. I mean, he was unbelievable.
Actually, we should explain for some people who may be joining us today that he was in the parachute regiment, a soldier. Yeah, okay. Mike, there's so much to talk to you about, because as I said, you've had this extraordinary career, but can we just find out how it all started? I mean, you weren't born into motor racing in any way at all, were you?
No, I was born into the licence trade.
Yeah.
My father had pub and I worked in that until I was about 18, 19. Then when I was 21, I was in the Guinness Book of Records as the youngest licensee in the country, which you had to be 21 in those days. And I was licensee when I was 21 and a few days. And then I'd taken up rallying for myself, just club rallying and a little bit.
Driving?
Yeah.
Were you any good?
Not good enough. I got very friendly with Roger Clark and sort of one stage with him that he used to have up at his farm convinced me that I was wasting my money. So gave that one up. And during that time, I used to get, from the time I was eight, I used to jump on my bike and ride from Bognor up to Goodwood. Never missed a club meeting, never missed a thing. Always used to stand in the same place. I can look at photographs and this little dot, I can pick it out as me, because I used to be at the chicane where the two fences met. There I was. And I used to love it. And I was up there one day when Derek had his Lotus 31 and he broke the lap record, 130.6 it was, I think, in those days. And
yep.
My brother-in-law used to work for the local Bognor Bugle or whatever it was called. And I used to just pick up the sheets from the office and take them. He'd write a story around them, around what I'd said, and it was the only thing that picked up, and he'd broken the lap record. And I happened to meet him in the pub in Pagham one night, and he said, oh, yeah, great. And we became friendly, and I got involved with him then. That was about 65, 66.
Amazing.
So that was pure chance, just running into him in the pub.
Yeah, it was, yeah. It just shows that going to the pub's a good thing. So, I was also, by then I'd given up the pub and I was working at a company called Hair Spares. They weren't purveyors of wigs. They actually, they did things for cars, motor accessories, because in those days, you know, if you wanted an ashtray, it was an extra. And yes. Radios were definitely
Paddy
extra.
Paddy Hopkirk switch extensions via Mini, that kind of thing.
You were the bloke that bought those. So we did all that. And through them, I got them to do all sorts of things. When Derek bought the terrible Lotus 41, he wanted it gold and black, and the spray shop did that for him. And then we gave him a bit of sponsorship, and that's really how I got involved with it.
I mean, Formula 3 back then was, apart from being incredibly exciting racing, it was bloody dangerous, wasn't it? I mean, you know, what do you remember about those races those days?
I don't think they were dangerous.
No?
We didn't think so at the time anyway. You never do you? I mean, you really think it's dangerous.
I talked to Chris Kraft about this a couple of years ago, and he said the 1967 Italian, 66-67 Italian F3 Championship was dangerous.
Yes.
He said it was terrifying. Yeah. I mean, you know, rewarding when he did well, but...
I mean, some of the tracks, I think, are the Continental Circuit.
Oh, yeah, yes. I think it was more the fact that there, I mean, I don't think it was so much in the UK.
British circuits were pretty good by those standards of that day. I mean, we'd invert in, you know, we'd sort of managed to make more straw bales and stuff like that. It wasn't, and then Armco arrived. I mean, but I mean, some of the places like Chimay, Rouen. I mean, Rouen was unbelievable. I mean, fantastic place. I was there the day that they had a massive shunt there. I think three guys died there.
Jean-Luc Salomon.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful racer. I mean, the reason I said dangerous, actually, is because it was such close racing. I mean, the slipstreaming and the, you know, to be in the lead pack, you had to be good, didn't you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was all different. I mean, it was the same in Formula 2. Anything at Hockenheim. I mean, when we used to go to Hockenheim, you used to spend more time in setup, in making sure that your mirrors were right. Because you had to be able to see without moving your head. Because when there were 14 of you going down the straight, you wanted to know that the guy you were going to zap out and slipstream had seen you. And if you did that, he knew he'd seen you, so he could do it. If you didn't, then he wasn't sure. So you just be able to move your eyes so that you could get the mirrors right. But it was different, but it was tremendous racing.
Let's talk a bit about Peter Gethin for two reasons. One, you had huge success with Geth, and secondly, he's never, in my view, really ever been given his fair share of plaudits and credit for what he achieved. I don't know why. Would you agree with that?
Probably not. He was good when we won the whatever it was, the 5000 championship with the M10A. We took that to the States and won a couple of races for that because we got so many points ahead in Britain. We decided we'd go and conquer the States as well, which was a bit of a mistake. We did win races, but it was hard going. Because he was so closely linked for a long time to McLaren.
Yeah.
I remember the first time he drove a Can-Am car. It was a brand new car and neither Denny or Bruce could be there in the morning. And put Geth in it, and out he went. And he kept coming back in and saying, Jesus, unbelievable, unbelievable. It's like low flying. Oh, it's unbelievable. And Denny arrived and we took the throttle stop out. he was very, very good.
He was also a great guy. I mean, you know, you didn't spend long with him without having a laugh, did you? He was a great character, Gethin.
I had the pleasure of driving around the States with him with an old Ford estate car that we bought for, I think, $150 in the rotten, worst place in New York where all the dodgy car dealers were. That's all we could afford. And we were driving around the States in this thing, and we used to have about a quarter of oil in it every 100 miles. And we were driving from Paramus, New Jersey, Fred Opeth's workshop, over to California. And we must have got stopped 15 times for speeding. And we'd pay our fine and carry on. And, you'd be in a traffic jam. And he'd lean over and take the keys out of the car and chuck them out the window. And you had to get out and find them and fire it back up again. And I got stopped once and I was doing a fine job. The cop was saying to me, "So, where are you from?" "Oh, we're from England." "Oh, yeah? Whereabouts in England?" "Middle. My daughter's in Oxford." "Oh, really? Is she in university?" "Yeah, she is." "Oh, right. Yeah, we're from Oxford." "Oh, right. What does she look like?" "Yeah, well, she's small and dark. I think I know her." This used to go on. And, you get halfway through the thing and Gethin would lean across and say, "Officer, don't listen to him. He's given that nonsense to everybody that stops us, and we've had 12 today." But he was good fun to be with. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of very good stories. Some of them I can tell, some of them I can't.
But, sure. There was a little bit of Gerhard Berger in Geth, I think. He seems as the humour. And
yeah, he was...
Well, same attitude to a lot of things, really. Yes.
Yes. No, Geth was very special. He was special. He was very easily tipped. That was his problem. You know, you could walk up to Geth and... I always remember when he'd left us and he was driving for other people, and you could walk up to him and say, "God, Geth, when you were with us, I knew you were brilliant, but phew, watching that car through there, it's all over the place. It's understeering, oversteering. Only someone like you could drive it." And you knew he was driving for, would come down 10 minutes later and said, "You've been talking to Gethin. Been changing springs." And he was a very special, lovely man, beautiful man.
You also ran Carlos Pace, didn't you?
Yeah,
and we've never had anybody on a podcast who's done that. I mean, was he a huge talent, Mike?
Massive, absolutely massive. Again, a lovely bloke who was very humble, but knew what he wanted. He wasn't a pushover, but blindingly quick. I mean, I think if he'd been in the right place at the right time. I mean, I know that Bernie thought he was wonderful, and he was. He was a great guy, huge talent. We didn't do that much with him because we were running the old Formula 2 Pygmies at the time.
Yeah.
And it was sponsored by a Brazilian bank, I think it was, who either ran out of money or forgot to send it. So, but yeah, Pache was very special.
You, Nigel, you watched him race, of course, didn't you?
I watched him race a lot, yeah. And in fact, I remember it was just before the Race of Champions, I think, in 77, that he was killed in that plane crash, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah. That was a terrible time because that was right after Tom Price had been killed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, he was a lovely bloke.
So you mentioned Bernie Ecclestone, Mike, and of course some people, maybe understandably actually, have kind of forgotten that, you know, he is deep down at heart a racer, a racing fan, and he, of course, had the Brabham team. And you've known him on and off all these years. This is a bit of a flyer for you, but...
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, looking at Formula One today, we'll come to it a bit later, but... do you think Bernie, you know, it's kind of he's had his time? What's your gut feeling about that now?
It's election time. I'll probably give you a politician's answer, but I'm not close enough to it now to make a decision. All I know is that I was there when he first came along, and I know what Formula One was then and what it is now. And without him, a lot of people wouldn't be where they are today.
Sure.
Hey, he's made mistakes, haven't we all? And I think he, on the basis of that, he's been very good for all sorts of things. I think a lot of what he does goes unnoticed. I think in the age of the internet, it's very easy for people to make their criticisms without knowing the full facts. Yeah. And he takes his fair share of that. But he's a much, much more positive element to motorsport than negative by a long, long way.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Really, my only beef is not with Bernie, it's with CVC.
Yeah, well, likewise.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, Bernie, as you say, has made it what it is, and he's got very rich along the way. Fair enough, you know, he did it. They don't do anything; they just take.
But we can blame Bernie for bringing CVC in.
What?
We can blame Bernie for bringing CVC in.
Well, we certainly can. Yeah, absolutely, we certainly do that. But the thing that you know upsets me more than anything is the way the heritage of Formula One is being lost. Because, but I mean, how many? I don't know. We're going to have 6 races in Europe this year.
It's not very many.
Now Germany's gone. So it's a lot of the time Formula One is taking place in countries that couldn't care less about it. And Bernie has always said, "Oh well, it's on TV. It doesn't matter." It actually does matter. The fans feel that a lot of fans feel that it's. Being Formula One is becoming distant from them because where the hell's, you know, wherever it is, Qatar, you know,
I think
what's that got to do with Formula One? You know,
we could ask you, Mike, about we're jumping ahead slightly here and we'll go back again in a minute. But I mean, you had the Onyx Formula One team, and inside Formula One is a very different place from. Anywhere outside Formula One, isn't it? I mean, you're not actually thinking about whether you're giving value for money to the fans or whether it's accessible or not. You're completely focused on the racing.
Yeah, you are, but I think you do think about the fans because, you know, without them, there's no point being there. And there's no point anybody putting money into Formula One as a sponsor, partner or anything like that unless it appeals to the public. What I do disagree with about Formula One now is I think some of the measures that have been taken to spice it up, so to speak, have been counterproductive.
Yeah,
I think it's wrong. It's a part of what was there when we were doing it, you know, about 1066. It was you wanted a driver who could look after his tyres and then smash his gearbox to bits and, you know... Today, it's not quite the same. There's so many electronic safety nets for them, and they know that they've got, you know, at least 2 tyre stops to make and all these sorts of things. Yeah. And I don't think it helps the fans at all, because it's very good if you're sitting opposite the pits, but they haven't got enough big screens around the circuit to know who's gone in and who hasn't and where they've rejoined and... So they've turned it into a television sport.
Yeah.
Do you feel that it's to me, one of the problems with it, and people do say this, is it's become so complicated.
Yeah, it is.
Rules spawn more rules, and they can't keep track of it. People are sort of, what are engine tokens? And so why has he got more engine tokens than Mercedes or whatever? It just seems to me year by year it becomes ever more complicated. And Brundle actually was saying this, the same thing, just in terms of the number of things they have to explain before they start.
I mean, I actually like some of the engineering complexity, some of it, but I think it's become pointlessly complex in so many ways now that it's just, you know, unless you are actually on the inside, it can be baffling.
I've always thought that if you look at it, it's really a reflection of modern life because everybody tries to please everybody.
Yeah.
And it's the same with governments and everything, you know. And you end up with a situation where you end up pleasing nobody. And I think that's what's happened to Formula One. They've tried so many remedies to fix something that fundamentally wasn't broken.
And the other thing about the complexity of the modern rule book is that it's also very restrictive, and a lot of the stuff that we saw during the 70s and 80s, whether it's sliding skirts or Brabham fan cars or 6-wheel Tyrrells, you know, nowadays everything, 10 minutes after the regulations come out, the science of the wind tunnel dictates everything looks the same, and it's just, it doesn't have the same engineering fascination, for me at least.
No, I mean, when you see people like Adrian Newey, who is effectively bored with it because QED, the regulations determine what he can do, and he's got a mind that is racing, you know, 20 years ahead of what's there now, it's so frustrating for him. It really is. So, yeah, I think you're right.
As you brought up the subject, Rob, of the Onyx Formula One team, one question I have to ask. Jean-Pierre Van Rossum, Moneytron, your sponsor.
You beat me to it.
Discuss.
Well, funnily enough, when we did our launch at the Hippodrome in London, Nigel described it as the most tasteless thing he'd ever seen in his life.
Is that the car or the lawn?
Oh, daddy, I'm sorry, I've forgotten that.
On reflection, he was probably right. But at the time, I was sorely hurt by the fact that a journalist should be discussing taste.
Hey, now's your chance to get right back at him.
But, and also, we'd worked all night to get the car there. And we took it off the trailer and put it outside prior to bringing it through the side door. And when I went back out, there was some job's worth had clamped it. And I do have a piece of video, because we had a film crew there, of me arguing with this Jobsworth to get the clamp taken off so that we could tuck it in to put it on the lift. It's a fabulous picture, and there's this Jobsworth stood there, and I'm poking him in the chest. You've got to let it go, mate. He should have left it, we'd have probably been quicker. So so we
would you like to tell us a little bit about the launch?
Well, I can't remember a great deal about it. I mean, Mike has reminded me what I said at the time, but I mean, it's a long time ago, and I can't remember much clear detail. I do remember thinking, I must say, and I think a lot of people thought the same thing from the outset. Moneytron,
yeah,
that doesn't sound kosher. Just does not sound
well. Also, we had on the side of the car an emblem which was Petit Lou, which was a baby clothing company, which was owned by his lady. And it looked uncannily like a pound sign. People had Moneytron on it, and they thought, oh, how gross, it's got this pound sign on the side. He was, funnily enough, he was a clever guy. He was a professor of economics at Louvain University. That's how he started out. And he invented this computer program which was predictive, so that if the President of the United States got shot, he predicted what would happen to the price of oil and the price of gold and all this. And he sold the system to banks for a lot of money. I mean, I think he was charging about $5 million a pop at the time. And he got it going quite well. And he had a lot of very heavy-hitting investors involved in it. And that's how, but he had an absolute love of cars. I mean, I could do this whole program with Van Rossum stories, but he was absolutely unique. Those of you who've obviously never seen the pictures, he had hair down to over his shoulders.
Well, and it also looked as though his hair probably could lubricate a car. He seemed never to wash it. It was, right, I remember. Yeah, yeah.
But some of the funny ones, we were at Rickard, and we picked up our first points there. I think we had a fifth with Stefan. And at the time, Porsche were talking about coming back with what was effectively two of their V6 turbo engines put together with a central power takeoff and a long, heavy lump it was. Anyway, they came and saw us, and Bernie fetched them down and said, look, this is where you want to be and all this. So off we go to Weissach and meet them all, and Van Rossum says, I will come to the meeting. This is very important. So, yeah, fine, meet you there. No, I will fly over in the jet to Gatwick and pick you up. Good. So he arrives, long hair onto his shoulders and a suit on, because he always wear tracksuit bottoms and racing boots. And so he turned up, and we jumped on the plane, and the young lady said, would you like anything to eat? And he said, well, what have you got? So she said, So unfortunately, he decided on an egg mayonnaise baguette. which when he bit into it, put egg mayonnaise all down his suit, all down his shirt, in his hair, and he was pulling it out of his hair and eating it. And so we arrive at Porsche, and long story. Anyway, in the end, the deal was agreed. And as we leave, absolute confidentiality. Nobody must say anything until it's done, and da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, we'll have a joint press release. But next morning, I got a phone call from Pierre Bonfleet, who said, you've got Porsche. I said, pardon? He said, yeah. I said, well, no, I don't know anything about it. Well, he was on television last night talking about it. So, of course, swiftly followed by a phone call from Porsche. He wanted nothing more to do with it. So I rang him and said, Porsche have withdrawn because of your television appearance. He said, this was not me. I said, excuse me. Not too many look like it. I subsequently got a phone call in the evening to say, your man has made the news down here. I said, what's he done now, for crying out loud? He said, he drove his Porsche down to the main square and set fire to it. That showed him. So, yeah, he was very special. I always remember he said, we went down there one day and there was Alan Jenkins and I, and he sat there and he said, I want this to be a big team. I want us to have our own test track. I want us to have our own wind tunnels and our own carbon factory and everything. Do the work. So I go out and I go up and see the Earl of March and agreed a bit of land we could lease to put a factory on. I thought, it's a nice little test circuit. Got all the quotes in for all the bits he wanted, and that was it. But coming up to the meeting we were having with him, I had a row because there was a payment late with him. So I was pretty annoyed with him. And we got on the plane to go out there, and I said to Jenks and Joe Chamberlain was with me, I said, listen, if he goes on any more about Fanta, because he used to drink gallons of Fanta, cans and cans. He used to have a big, in his office, wooden cabinet, one of which was a fridge, and it was full of Fanta. I said, if he offers me a Fanta today, I'm going to tell him where to stick it. So we go in, and he sits down. Well, how's it gone? I said, well, we've got the factory on this site, and we've got the wind tunnel, and we've got the thing, and great, do it all. Would anybody like a Fanta? Yes, please. Can I have two? he was pretty special.
He did. Bernie wasn't keen on him, and I mentioned him in passing to Bernie 4 or 5 years ago, and Bernie just went horrible bastard.
But I always remember we went to the Belgian Grand Prix, which obviously was the important one for him. For Van Rossum, and he'd gone to press with, you know, Belgium's biggest newspaper, whatever that is, and he'd said what he wanted to say by denial. So he said, I want you to know now, I never said Jean-Marie Balest was a Nazi. I never said that. I never, ever said that Bernie Eccleston was the Mafia, ever. So I arrived not knowing this, and Herbie Blash has come out. He said, Bernie wants to see you. So, fine, what's this? So I thought the truck was too long or the canopy was dirty or whatever. Anyway, Bernie told me the story. He said, get him up here. So I said, right, okay, fine. So anyway, I just said, Bernie wants to see you. Oh, good. So he walked up, and Ben Rossum stood in front of him, and he looked at him and said, listen, you, I've seen them come, I've seen them go, and I'm not frightened of the dark. Now go away, or words to that effect. He used to have about 8 very beautiful models at every race, and he had them equipped with clothing from whoever the best designer was at the time, all in the team's colours. I think we were in Detroit, and Bernie came down the pit road and he said, get all those birds out of this place, they're doing my head in. So we had to dispatch them.
Oh boy.
What happened to him, Mike? What happened to Van Rossum?
Well, he eventually, they found out that he'd been embezzling money. Now, there's a surprise. looked like a straight guy to me. So, they tried to indict him and put him away. But apparently, if you're an MP in Belgium at that time, you couldn't be charged with a civil matter. So he stood for Parliament. And strangely, he offered everybody free houses, free cars, free everything. And he got elected. It was absolutely amazing. So he did 2 years of that. And the story goes that when the King of Belgium was opening Parliament, he jumped up and shouted, "Vive la République!" And they arrested him. And he went to he went to prison for 3 years. I don't know where he is now.
Oh, boy. I tell you, only Formula One could come out of this. I think we can't let this pass, Mike, without staying in Belgium for a couple of minutes, because it was in Belgium that David Purley had that absolutely fantastic Grand Prix where I think it's fair to say he found himself in the lead. And it'd be really nice to hear, you know, from you, straight from the horse's mouth, as it were, how all that came about, because he really shouldn't have been leading the race, should he? I mean, and there were only about three of you in the pits, weren't there, or something?
I think that basically you're doubting the sort of brilliance of the technical decisions I made.
Okay, basically. Well, hands up.
It started wet, and we went out on wets just like everybody else, and after about 10 laps it dried out, and there were three of us in the whole team, and we figured that it looked a bit cloudy, it might rain again, and we figured that it would take us about 3.5 weeks to change the tyres. So we just kept going, and everybody came in and we were leading, and a bit of an altercation afterwards with Nicky, because he held Nicky up for quite a long time. And but that was David. He just said to me afterwards, he said, "Who's the guy in the red car with the red helmet?" I said, "Where's Nicky Lauda in a Ferrari?" "Oh, all right. I think he might be a PF sister." So I'm fine. Okay. So we go. Anyway, Nicky came up to interview him with about 500 journalists. And there was a bit of finger pointing, which Pearly responded to fairly robustly. And but they became very, very good friends afterwards. Very good
did
friends.
They?
Yeah,
no,
very good friends. We had to put a rabbit on the side of the
car.
Well,
I was going to say, I remember that. Yeah,
yeah, Nicky
yeah.
said that we were... they shouldn't allow rabbits in races, and Pearly sort of called him the rat, and that's where it kind of stuck.
Yeah.
So that's where it all came from. But I know when David had his accident at Silverstone, Nicky was on it every day. Is he all right? Is there anything we can do?
Really?
You know, he was great. Really good. Fantastic.
I don't want to go over the grisly bits, but I mean, just going back, I mean, what was that like? I mean, looking back, Silverstone 77, I mean, a tiny team, all built around one guy. He was the hub of the team. You're all friends. I mean, how did you all cope with that?
At the time, I mean, all the friendship bit and small team goes out the wall. Brian Henson came in and he stopped at our pit and he said, he's had a big one and he's a bad one out the back. So we dashed off and got our support vehicle, which was a Mark 1 Cortina, a state wagon.
Oh, well.
Proper one.
Big budget.
And we threw a few tools in the back and drove out there. And it was surrounded by rescue vehicles. And as we ran around the corner, Greg Field, who was working with me at the time, he collapsed. He just fell on the floor. I mean, the car was just... The two roll hoops, the front and the rear, were so close together, his head was sideways in them. And... when we got there, I was amazed he was still alive. Mm. And I mean, we all know he recovered and went back, but it was terrifying at the time. We thought we'd lost him. And I'll always remember the doctor working on him said, "I'm losing him, I'm losing him. You're going to have to keep him interested. Talk to him." So I said, "What have you done?" And he said, "Brakes didn't work." I said, "That's nonsense. I can see skid marks right up the road. You've wrecked our weekend." And we were having this huge argument. And I've always thought to this day, people who didn't know what were going on, yeah, thinking, what a heartless piece of work that bloke is. But it kept him going.
You were keeping him alive.
Yeah, yeah. While we got him in the ambulance. And in the ambulance, he said to me, "Can you get the car ready for tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, if you can get ready, I'll be ready. Don't worry about it." But yeah, it was pretty horrific.
I did happen to see that accident. Yeah. Believe it or not, and it was one of those that you just literally assumed instantly, yeah, that's not survivable. No. So, and I'll never know, no, to this day how he did.
His old man, Charlie, who, you know, he was a fishmonger, he made good by making fridges. He made a fridge, he used to pick up fridges, fish from Bognor Railway Station, take it on a trades bike. Then he had such a big ground, he needed a refrigerator, so he built one and he sold one to the local butcher. And that's how Leck Refrigeration started. And I rang him, he was playing golf. I said, Charlie, David's had a massive shunt. He said, oh, has he? Oh, right. Well, I'm on the 11th. He said, you're a good man. You'll take care of everything. Oh, and by the way, here's my telephone credit card number. Use that. Don't keep putting money in the things. No mobiles in those days. So I kept ringing him. It was after about a week, I said, are you coming up to see him? And he said, yeah, I'll bring his mother up. So, fine, okay. Well, Pearlie's laying in bed. And he's got a tube in his throat, and his head is the size of a big melon, but black. And as we're walking into his room, I've said to Charlie, look, Charlie, it's not a pretty sight, so be prepared for a shock. And he turned around and said to his wife, well, there you are, Joyce, don't be doing anything silly. So, right, we walked in. As we opened the door, Charlie collapsed on the floor. Mrs. Pearlie was great. But yeah, it was a bad, bad day.
The best thing is that we can laugh about it today, isn't it? Because the guy was, I mean, you know, a lot of men wouldn't have survived that. He was tough as hell, and he was fit. He was very, very fit, David Pearlie, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. He used to run 8-9 miles every day, and yeah, he used to have his Irish wolfhound, which used to go with him. He used to say, come on, Wolf, we'll go running. And I think Wolf used to try to get back in his basket. He didn't want anything to do with it. But he was remarkably fit and remarkably determined. I mean, didn't what you did with him, whether you were, you know, playing tiddlywinks, he had to win. Yeah. He was a unique character. He had no understanding of... he didn't really want to understand the incident. He'd have been hopeless in Formula One today because he couldn't understand what it was about. I mean, he and James together were a win double. I mean, you know, we all got on the bumper cars at Zandvoort and got chased out of the fair by the fairground people trying to turn them over.
They were quite similar characters, actually, weren't they, in some ways?
The other thing about him was that I remember doing an interview with him in the sort of mid-70s, not very long before the accident, actually. And he's about the only racing driver I can ever remember speaking to, apart from Stirling, who actually believed it should be dangerous.
Yeah,
I mean, he truly did. I mean, he was even then he was very concerned about the sort of milk and water circuits that were being used and places like Chimay, you know, were falling into.
No, he did. He was that way. He thought that, you know, it was something that he was doing, but he wanted that. I mean, you know, he'd been in the paras and he jumped out and his parachute failed to open. And he rode down on the top of another parachute when he broke the other bloke's shoulder and his leg. But he was always looking for a thrill. He loved things that were right on the edge. Hence, he went up, you know, and took up aerobatic flying. But he was a quite remarkable character. I mean, he really was.
He was.
I got to know James from when we were doing the Philip Morris driver promotion thing, the World Championship team. And you're right, there were a lot of similarities.
Which brings us on, and we are jumping about here, but we have to because it's 5 decades. But talking about James and Marlborough brings us to Stefano Modena. You can't really imagine a more different person to David Pearlie than Stefano Modena, really. But he, apart from bringing you and the team huge success and you bringing him his success, I mean, he won the Formula 3000 championship. And everybody said at the time, Mike, you know, this guy.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This guy is something special. This guy's going to be world champion. This guy's going to take Formula One to pieces. And why didn't he? What happened there?
Two reasons, really. After he won the Formula 3000 championship, which was 87, during 88 we decided we were going to build a Formula One car, and we had started on it. And at that time I was talking to Philip Morris, and they were looking to have what really amounted to what today is called a junior team. And it was going to run in gold and white for Marlboro Lights as opposed to red and white. And we were quite well advanced with the car, and obviously we were going to take Modena and one of the other guys out of this young driver scheme, which, to coin a well-used phrase, was a victim of its own success, because we produced so many good drivers. I mean, in 87, every championship we had a driver in, we won the championship. And Modena was amongst them. And we were going to do that. Well, halfway through it, America decided they didn't want to do it. We had a car half finished, so we had to stop that and aim for 89, which left Modena at a bit of a loose end, and he ended up doing Eurobrone and all sorts of things. Yeah. It was the only place to go. His other bit of bad luck was that at the end of 87, Bernie rang up and said, "This guy Modena, is he any good?" And I said, "Yeah, I think he is. I think he's exceptional," which he was. I know Senna rated him very highly. I talked to Senna at Spa about him, and he said, yeah, because they raced against one another a lot in karts. And Modena had a good record against him, and Ayrton said, yeah, this guy will be special. And so our chance with him had gone in 88, and we were then flapping around to try and get the car built. And Stefano had to go off and do what he had to do. The bit of bad luck was the end of 87. Bernie had called up and said, "Is he any good?" And I said, "Yeah, I think he is. I think he's exceptional." And he said, "Right, get him down to Australia. I'll run him there." And he went down there. He never fitted in the car. He was in big trouble with that. He wasn't particularly big, but he couldn't get comfortable in the car. I think he qualified reasonably well. I think he was about 11th or something. But in morning warm-up, he's more time in the car. I think he was in the top four or five. But I think after halfway through the race, his feet went to sleep and he retired. Had Bernie not decided at that point to sell Brabhams, he would have been at Brabhams the next year.
Yeah. Right place at the right time again, or wrong place. Yeah.
And we've all seen hundreds of drivers. You know, he's not the only one that suffered that
way. I was going to ask actually, Mike, because I mean, you know, I first met you in sort of 83, 84 when you were running the...
1883,
was it? 1880, yeah. And, you know, you had loads and loads of good young drivers who passed through the system. Yeah. I mean, who, apart from Stefano, who are the others that you felt could, should have made it, but didn't ultimately?
Well, one that very definitely did make it was James and I. The way this scheme used to work all the territories from Marlborough, because what happened was, in the beginning, you'd have 18 Italian drivers sponsored by Marlborough and 23 Frenchmen, but nobody from anywhere else because it was only budget. So I convinced them that they should take a percentage of everybody's budget, put it in a pool, and then we'd have a thing at the beginning of the year. So guys who'd done Formula 4 running with Dick Bennett's in Formula 3 had a test day, and we'd make a decision. There'd be about five of each of them, and they'd all get a set number of laps and tyres to make the decision. So the scheme was quite well set up. They bought into it, and it was quite well set up. And through that became one that was very successful was Mika.
Yeah.
And the story that I don't think has been told, which is true, James and I were sitting in the office in Chiswick. We had a day of going through these long forms that the territories had to send in, ticking off numbers out of 10, why this should be the guy that should be supported. And we'd finished. It was 7 o'clock, and James said, come on, mate, time to go and have a pint. So fine, we got up to go out, and as we were walking out through the secretary's office, there was another one of these forms on the desk, and I said, what's that one? He said, I don't know. Come on, let's go and advise me, then have a look. Yeah, we ought to give him a test. That was Mika Häkkinen. That's how close it came to not helping.
Whoa.
But Mika came along, McNish, Pirro, Dalmas, they all came through the scheme. And it worked very well.
But I mean, who are the other guys, I mean, from that lot, who are the ones that you really rated? You felt, I mean, obviously Modner could have made it with a, you know, had the wind been blowing in a different direction.
Obviously Häkkinen, McNish. McNish was underrated. Again, wrong place, wrong time. You know, we took him, we had a few races with him in 3000.
In 92.
Yeah, when he was test driver at McLaren. And I'd known Alan for a long time and his father. And I think, as has turned out, he's a very bright, clever guy and a good driver, tremendous team player.
Yeah.
Pirro, obviously. Definitely. Well, I had Pirro for 3 years in Formula 2 and Formula 3000. Never, I mean, I love him dearly, but he was never top 10 material. But a good driver. I mean, you know, we're talking fractions here. You know, anybody, it doesn't matter who they are, if they get into Formula One through ability, they're a good driver. And the difference between being a good driver and an exceptional driver, I mean, you can see it. The good ones are always 10 metres ahead of the car, and the bad ones are 30 metres behind it, sorting out what's already happened.
And then there's Beppe Gabbiani.
Yeah.
Should we give Beppe a mention, do you think?
I was going to, if you weren't, but I'm glad you brought the subject up. Because, I mean, before we started recording, I do remember in 1984, Thierry Tassin was your regular driver. He was off doing the Spa 24 hours, and Beppe stood in.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that he busted drive shaft doing a practice start from the end of the pit lane in the race car. The mechanic stuck him in the spare, whereupon he went to the end of the pit lane, did a practice start, and bust another drive shaft. I'm fairly sure that happened.
I don't think that was us, because he did a whole season with us.
In 83, he was with you.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
But in 84, he subbed for Thierry. I do remember that happening.
Yeah. He is a journalist, you know. I mean,
I wouldn't make anything up.
But
yeah, he just did one race with for you in 84, so when Tassin wasn't there. Yeah. And I just remember he didn't actually do the race because he was too busy breaking drive shaft.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, I can't remember that. But he was special, again, in a very, very different way. He's totally, totally laid back. And it was just about the time that the headsets had come in. And we were running, what's his name? Scott, young English guy, Beppe Gabbiani and Tassin. And I went around one day, it's just before the start, and I said, what do you listen to, Scotty? Well, Land of Hope and Glory. Oh, fine. And I said, oh, right. What about you, Terry? What do you got on? Oh, the Carpenters, they're very good. Oh, right, okay, good. Beppe, what do you got? Black Sabbath. And you'd be on the grid with him, and, you know, they'd done the warm-up lap, and you'd be sitting there, and he'd be going, the lady in the third row, she's showing her knickers. He was very special. I'll always remember he'd had the year before with Maurer, and it had been pretty unsuccessful. And when he won the first race of the season, as he crossed the line at Silverstone, he veered towards the pit wall. And I thought, oh, that was a celebration, but it wasn't. He was giving rude signs to Willie Maurer as he went by. But he was talented. Peter Gethin, who was engineering him at the time, actually went on to handle his management for a while. But he was definitely very, very, he was an interesting guy.
Oddly, we have answered a lot of our readers' questions. Just
without actually asking them.
So, I'd like to take one from Andy Gearing, just to change the pace a little bit, Mike. He's asking, given the current restrictions, do you think it's even remotely viable to enter a new team into Formula One these days and enjoy any kind of success?
The only way you can do it is if you're somebody like Haas, who has the money. I mean, the raw material of motor racing has always been, but even more so than now, is money. You know, when RD took over McLaren, if he hadn't been so good at finding sponsors and giving them what they wanted, McLaren's wouldn't be what it is today. It was because he had the money to spend to do it. Ferrari have always been in that situation. If somebody came in, and you know, let's not mess about, lots of big companies have come in, Toyota spent a fortune and not made it. So it's not just a case of the money, you've got to, and it takes time to put the ingredients together. I mean, Red Bull, fantastic. They didn't come in and blitz the world. They had lots of money. Yeah. You've got to put all the infrastructure in place. And that goes from everything, from not just designers, but, you know, people who look after the factory. And that takes time. That's a 3 or 4 year project. And someone's got to be prepared to put up that level of investment for 3 or 4 years. Yeah. I think for people to come in and try and do it on a shoestring budget, particularly as, you know, you're not getting any money from the organisers for a couple of years, if you're lucky. It's very, very difficult. And I, in answer to the question, without money, definitely not. With money, it's still very difficult.
I was going to say, I mean, Red Bull, yes, they did have money, but they made a success of something that the Ford Motor Company, who also have money, failed.
The reason they did it was they had people involved who could identify the ingredients to the cake. If you come into it totally cold and you don't have people who know the right ingredients, it's going to take you longer. And I think in Toyota's case, they went at it and they went outside of Formula One effectively, initially, to get what they want. The most important year for somebody trying to do it is the first year. That's when you put down the foundations on which the whole project is built. And if you get that wrong, so if you were doing it, you'd probably spend 2 or 3 years drawing the plan of how you're going to do it, trying to recruit the people you wanted before you actually did it. It's no good getting in there and then saying, Jesus, this is harder than I thought it was. Throw more money at it.
Mike, another question from Matt, who says, he quotes Derek Bell, actually, as being a supporter of the view that there are just too many open-wheeler single-seater series and there aren't enough seats further down the line for all the guys, even some of the quick ones. Do you think that's true? Do you think that it's too much skewed? Everything is too much skewed towards getting to Formula One? Because a lot of really good guys now are making a good living in the World Endurance Championship.
Yeah, but I think, you see, that's been a hobby horse of mine for a long time, since there have been this plethora of single-seater formulas, because there is a finite amount of money that's available for motor racing. If you're trying to spread that over 20 different championships, nobody's getting much money, so nobody can do a proper job, and the whole thing is self-defeating. I think that there should be a limit on how many national single-seater championships there are, and definitely international championships.
And of course, we've got the new FIA Formula 2 championship coming up, which we really need to go with GP2 and Renault 3.5 and GP3.
You can't have enough formulas.
and with a diminishing number of Formula 1 cars to Formula 1 teams to aim at.
Yeah, so. Really.
Okay. I mean, it's one more question from one of our loyal motorsport readers. And this one comes from Daniel Smith. And Daniel, Mike, wants to know, this is about Stefan Johansson. We all like Stefan, don't we? How good was Stefan's third place drive at Estoril in 1989? And obviously Daniel remembers this in particular, but can you cast
your mind?
That
was when he was on the just about on the rims, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, that again is... it was a good drive. In real terms, without a couple of things, he'd have probably finished seventh or eighth. We had the Mansell Senna taking one another out, yep. Which moved us up. And then the other one was that Prost came in very early for a tyre change. And while we were having a discussion about what we thought we should do, he'd done two laps. But we noticed the second lap was as slow as the lap that he'd done just before he put the tyres on. The first lap was quick. Second one was back where he was. And we said, let's leave it and take a chance on it. And he just kept going, so he didn't stop. And he ended up being third. But it was a good drive, a very good drive. He was really, really hacked off because it was the first time for a long time he'd been on the podium and he ran out of fuel on the slowing down laps. So he didn't get out. I mean, we were on a tight budget. Fuel was expensive.
I presume by then you did have enough people to change the tyres by then.
Yes. And we got away from spoons and had proper levers. But no, it was just literally, look, he's gone there. And funnily enough, Stefan did, I think it was people can check the records, but it was in the top half dozen fastest laps in the race, two laps from the end, on the tyres that were knackered.
2 years old, yeah.
It must be incredibly satisfying for somebody like you, because people always talk about the drivers, understandably. I mean, it's the fans, you know, love the drivers, but if you manage a race like that, and obviously the fuel was pretty carefully managed as you ran out one half a lap after the finish, it must be incredibly satisfying that to get to the end and think, you know, we got everything right.
I think you can only say that when you win. Right. Third place was fantastic for us as a small team. You've got to remember in those days, I mean, Nigel will remember, but I think at some races you had 42 cars turn up.
You're right. I mean, it's almost beyond belief now, isn't it?
Yeah. We had 42 cars. 12 of us used to go and try and pre-qualify in the morning between 7:30 and 8. And if you didn't get through as one of the top four, you packed your van and went home.
Well, in fact, that's what David was doing when he had his accident, wasn't it? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So, and that's the way it was. So it was incredibly difficult to get into the race. But if you got through, you generally found you qualified somewhere between 12th and 16th because you were quicker than the people that were in there by right. Mm. I mean, with Stefan, I mean, that's one of the better stories as well. We're doing the Canadian Grand Prix. And a lot of my stories revolve around pit stops and our inability to manage them. But anyway, Stefan came in for tyres. And the guy on the paddle on the front waved him out. And the guy with the gun hadn't finished. So he let go of the gun as the car went. The weight of the gun took it under the wing, which ripped the gun off. But unfortunately, he took half the gantry with him.
Yes.
And Stefan, to this day, says that he pulled out, went down the pit road, and he knew that behind him, because his place was Prost, and I think it was Berger. And he said, I did a whole lap thinking, I'm going pretty well. None of those guys are overtaking me. And on the back, he's got this gantry swinging from side to side. So we got over that one. We got him in, took all that off and sent him out. And we had an umbrella, no pit purchase in those days. We had an umbrella. But unfortunately, the wind got under and it hovered over the circuit for about 5 minutes. Unfortunately, it blew back to where I could drive. From that day, Bernie banned umbrellas. Yeah. We were quite serious, you know.
Great. Let's come a little bit nearer the present time. you've been touring car racing, of course, with Ford, and that was actually a really, really interesting project, because that was a gas-powered engine. Yeah, Calagas, in fact, if we want to give the sponsor a bit of a mission.
Yeah,
so tell us how you got into all that.
Well, basically, Tom Onslow Cole, his father had a business that was converting petrol cars to gas cars.
Right.
He knew someone at Cala, and I discussed with them, with his father, the opportunity of them sponsoring us, and they said, only if you can run Calagas. And we said, yeah, okay, fine, no problem. So he looked into it, and so I discussed it with Alan Gow, and previous gas cars had been pretty inefficient and pretty useless. So I had a look at it, and in the past, everybody'd injected it as a gas. And we decided we'd inject it as a liquid.
Right.
So we had some special tanks made in Australia, and Calla made the gas for us. And it took us a little while to get it to work, but once it worked, it was unbelievable. I can say now, because it's all over, and they've been banned, but when we first ran the engine, Dave Mountain at Mountune rang me up, and he said, because I'm thinking to myself, oh, what sort of a chance have you taken here? So David rang me and said, I think we've got a problem. And I said, oh, right, okay, what is it? He said, well, we just run one of these things on the dyno for the first time, and we've not optimised it or changed anything yet. Bearing in mind that a good engine in those days was producing 320 horsepower. He said, we've just seen 370. Well, I said, ah, right, okay, well, get on and optimise it. So he did, and at one stage we did actually have to pull them back, but at one stage we had over 400 horsepower out of the thing.
Wow.
And what was happening was, because the gas was going in absolutely freezing cold, it was expanding, I've forgotten how many times, but it was enormous. Mm. And the detonation was pretty exciting, and the thing was just, it was, I mean, they could spin wheels up to sixth gear. I mean, it was so powerful. But it was a very, very interesting project. I think if we carried on another year, it would have been even better, but they cancelled the idea of it, and then it was stopped. You couldn't have done it with anything more serious than touring cars, because refueling it, you had to take the whole tank out, put another tank in. So yeah, for one start race, it was okay.
Well, they changed cars in Formula E, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a fantastic. Well, I was going to call it I guess it was an experiment in a way to begin with, wasn't it? But it was very successful and good for Ford. I mean,
it had been done before. It wasn't really. I mean, Ford didn't. I mean, to be honest, Ford never really had a great enthusiasm for touring cars in Britain. But it wasn't great for them, because they didn't have a gas-powered car.
Yeah,
It had to be an aftermarket addition to it.
Sure.
And they were working very hard on hybrids at the time, so it really didn't make too much sense to them.
Right.
Having forged the path you had forged through Formula 5000, Formula 2, Formula Atlantic, up to Formula 1, etc. I mean, how did you find the touring car arena? Did you get the same buzz from racing there?
No. The only thing that I got the same buzz from to doing single-seater racing.
Sports cars.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to do it when I was looking at it, you know, like all single-seater people, you know, when we were doing Formula 3000 or Formula 2 or Formula 1. I used to think it was for the old, you know, it was motor racing's answer to help the aged. And that's how I used to view it. And we got involved with Stefan, with an American group, who wanted to buy an Audi and run it, and we managed to get some money from Golf. And from that moment onwards, I was hooked on it. Mm. It's great. It is fantastic. And if you look at it now, outside of Formula One, it's the only place where the drivers and teams are actually getting proper money.
Yeah. And it's very exciting at the moment.
I think it is. I mean, you know, before I'd done it, I thought, well, it was, you know, literally in the old saying, going about as slowly as possible to win. But it's not. They're flat on it from start to finish.
Yeah.
And the cars now are very complex.
There's more technical freedom, which is...
Yes, there is more technical freedom. I think they have a danger, and that is the danger that they're now getting more and more manufacturers in who will drive the price up. So already, I mean, you know, when we were running the Zytec, it was possible to have a look at an LMP1 program that way round, but now those guys have driven it far beyond there. So, you know, there's definitely two leagues developing. I would like to see the people that build the cars, the Audis and, you know, Nissans, Toyotas, whoever doing it, to be obligated to sell at least two cars outside of their own works team.
It's a fixed ceiling price as well, yes. So they can just spend as much on it developing it as they want.
Exactly.
They can only sell it for X.
Well, which Porsche traditionally did for countless years, didn't they?
Exactly, and it worked. It worked for them, you know, because they don't give them away. There are people out there. I mean, a little while ago, about 4 years ago, we had someone approach us who, on the face of it, had unlimited money. Never saw it, but was playing that. I think they did have, to be fair. But their one request was that we had to be able to do it with the current Audi. And Audi didn't want to sell a car. Mm. And it didn't matter what you'd offered them, they didn't want to sell it. Mm. Which is, you know, it's fine. That's their decision. And I can understand why, because even when we ran the cars, the 2 years we ran with them, we had to have five people from Audi to help us run the car, mainly for the engine and the gearbox. But now that would be about 18 people from Audi to run the cars. Yes. So that makes it a lot more difficult for them. They just don't have that amount of people.
We've only got 10 minutes left, and we've barely touched the surface, actually. But anyway, we've done our best. Mike, if you were to go back to one period in this 5 decades, which would it be? If you could just have one more go at one more thing, which one would you choose?
Probably doing track talk down at Radio Victory with you, Rob. getting drunk in the Dog and Duck before we started.
It was actually called the Museum Gardens.
Oh, was it? All right. Okay.
Jack and Daisy.
All yes. Right. Okay. Yes. I think it would probably be Formula One, because a guy I admire a lot because of the way he operated. If I had a fault when we were doing Formula One, whatever money we got in, we spent, because we wanted to be at the pointy end as quickly as possible. And to be fair, you look at 89, brand new team, we had a third and a fifth.
Yeah.
You look at people now coming in with a lot less cars.
They die for it.
They die for it. So I gave up a little bit too easy when it all got a little bit political at the end of 89. And Eddie Jordan wouldn't. Eddie stuck in there. And it was tough, Freddie. I mean, I've always said to people, I remember when Keith Wiggins started with Pacific, he rang me up and he said, look, you've done it. Tell me about Formula One. And I said, hey, the first year is relatively easy. They pat you on the head and say, well done, you found your way to the circuit. The second year is that's a bitch. That's tough, the second year. And it always is. Second year is always more difficult. And Eddie stuck it out, and he had his problems, and we know he had his problems, and you know, I think, you know, Bernie helped him at the time, which was good, and Eddie stuck at it, and he got where I like to think we could have got to with Onyx. So I'd like to revisit that in the light of what I know now but didn't know then. We were always a little bit self-effacing, I suppose. We felt that we shouldn't be there. We almost felt as though we were interlopers. I always remember, can't remember quite well, it might have been Spain, and Bernie came down because there were a few extra garages there. All of the, you know, 14 cars that were trying to pre-qualify were out in the fields and, you know, in the car parks and everything, and Bernie came down and he said, look, I've given you a garage. If you don't pre-qualify, I'm going to come down here and you're in big trouble. But we managed to stay in there for the weekend, but we always felt as though we shouldn't really be there. And if we'd have done a proper second year, I think we'd have felt, yes, we should be there. And Eddie would have been coming in and he'd have been the one in that position. Yeah. Eddie got it right, I got it wrong.
It's interesting because I think, I'm pretty sure I'm right, that you've won a championship in every decade of your career, haven't you?
No.
I'd like to. I'm wrong.
I've won a race. in every decade.
Oh, really? Sorry, yeah. I thought you'd... Okay, okay.
I've won a race in every decade.
Yeah.
It doesn't amount to much, but it was... It's, hey, listen, when I joined, I didn't think I'd still be doing it. You know, I thought...
Sure.
You can talk. People can talk about the finance of the and the politics and all that sort of stuff, but the thing that still excites me is the racing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if you can stand on the, you can stand in the garage. We say stand on the pit wall. You can't do that anymore. But you stand in the garage, and you see, you know, 20 Formula One cars waiting to go to the start, and you don't get an adrenaline rush out of it. You did.
Yeah,
it's too late for you. I mean, it's. I still love the racing.
Yeah.
Hence the fact that I'll watch. I don't know, almost anything on television that's racing.
Yeah.
You say on television. If you had to buy a ticket to something nowadays, what would it be? MotoGP, Formula One, Historics at Goodwood. What would it be?
He doesn't have to. I get him a ticket.
Oh, right, you get him a ticket for Goodwood. But
yeah, they're very cheap, Rob. Thank you. Some of them are half price. I'd probably MotoGP. Mm. If it had to be a sports car, it'd be a 6-hour sports car. Like Silverstone this weekend, I'd have bought a ticket for.
Because I think a good race.
I think that's a perfect. That is a perfect scenario for sports cars. I mean, Le Mans is fantastic, and I'd love to go back and do it and do it and do it. But as regards keeping the excitement going, it's more difficult. A 6-hour race at Silverstone or anywhere is fantastic. Mm. Yes, you know.
Definitely.
When we won Nürburgring with the Zytec against the Audis, I think the Daily Telegraph described it as one of the best sports car. We took the lead with two laps to go. We overtook McNish with two laps to go with the Zytec, and it was so exciting. It really was. You could see it coming. We were going and going and going, thinking, well, did we get that last tyre change right and not put any fuel in? And it was coming and coming, and two laps from the end, we did it. And to be fair, McNish said he almost pulled over because he knew there was nothing he could do about it. But it was, you know, that was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, a close finish at the end of 6 hours is just thrilling, isn't it? It's just, it's gripping stuff, yeah. Yeah. Okay, Mike, what's happening right now? Because
there's a helicopter taking off. That's what's happening right now.
It's helicopter racing is going on. You're building cars at the moment.
Yeah, we've been involved for a little while with this TCR formula, which is touring cars again.
Yeah.
But built to a price cap. We had a look at it with Marcello Lotti and not a few other people, and said, just like all motor racing, touring car has got very, very expensive. I mean, you look at the British Touring Car Championship now, it's a lovely championship, well-run, exciting, good TV, but it's very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. So we had a look around and said, okay, well, most of the manufacturers are producing an energy performance vehicle, Civic Rs and GTIs and all sorts of things. Let's take those a little bit further. Not, you know, reinvent the wheel, but take them a little bit further and put a price cap on them, which was put on at €100,000. And that's the whole idea. I mean, there's an international series which has started, it was probably started too early, but if we told people it was going to start in 2016, they'd be ready in 2017. So it's going forward. There are a lot of manufacturers coming in. There are 11, maybe 12 national championships being signed for next year, so that people doing it will be able to move on to the international championship using the same product. It's just a way to give people a chance to get into touring car racing and not be spending abnormal amounts of money.
What's the budget now for the British Touring Car Championship?
We haven't done it for 2 years, but we reckoned that we were looking at something round about £400,000-£450,000. A lot of people operate on less. You know, some people go in at £250,000. Depends how. I mean, for a front-running team like Dynamics or 888 or people like that, I can't see they're running on a lot less than £350,000-£400,000. That's big money
per car.
And if you're, you know, if you're running two or three cars, it's a lot of money to find. I mean, you know, there's some good teams, and if you look at the moment at Motorbase, cracking little team, well run, nicely done. You know, they lost Airwaves this year as a sponsor. They're not there this year, and it's sad.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe we could persuade you to come back for part two one day. Because, for example, we haven't even mentioned the Sultan of Brunei. There's a story which we're not going to go into right now, but who knows, we might get Mike to go into that another time. I mean, there are so many things we haven't even talked about.
Thank God for that. I thought you were going to ask me for a song to finish.
can I just ask one more thing? I mean, you were talking earlier about the success of the Marlborough system, and it did bring a lot of people through, but it was also quite brutal in some ways. I mean, I'm just thinking of Alan McNish, who Vauxhall Lotus, success, Formula 3, success. First year in Formula 3000, success. A rubbish second year in Formula 3000 through no fault of his own, and was dropped like a stone. It didn't always seem a particularly sympathetic system.
I think the problem was that, again, with Alan, could have been a little bit of timing, but basically he did get his McLaren test drive out of it.
Yes.
Which was the opportunity for him to go forward. It just happened to, you know, coincide with the fact that McLaren were fairly well fixed at that time, and he was in a difficult place. Yes, it was brutal, but we did it. The whole package was a bit more than just giving them the money to go racing with. I mean, I don't know how much time we got, but I'll finish you with this story. We, when we set it up, we decided what the budget would be, say, for a 3000 team, and offer it to the team that was going to do it. But we always told the driver we had to find £20,000 more. So they didn't walk into it thinking, well, that's it, I don't have to do anything. So they all had to go out and find 20 grand from auxiliary budgets.
It's still quite cheap for an F3000 season, oh, 20
was,
grand,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but it was something.
Yeah.
So I spoke to Modena very late on, around about January, and he said, I said, have you got your money yet? What's going on? I have a man down here. You come down and see him. So I jumped on the plane and I went down there, picked me up at the airport and drove me into the Ferrari factory. And we went in and met Mr. Ferrari. And he, through his interpreter, said, did I think he was any good? And I said, yes, I think he's very good. And I think he will be okay. And he said, right, okay, very good. Good. We will help. And I had a book on Ferrari with me, a hardback book, and I said, I do feel bad about this, but could you sign this for me? And he did. And he said something in Italian to the lady, and she came back with the same book, but in a beautiful hand-tooled brown leather case with a Ferrari on, and he signed it. And we went down to see him not long before he died, just after we won the championship, and we were building the Formula One cars. And he said, "And what engines are you going to run?" And I said, well, we have to run a Cosworth. And he said, he called, I think it was Piccinini at the time, he called him in and said, how many of those turbos do we have? And the answer came. And because they were going back to normally aspirated, yeah. It was a year when you could run either. And, oh, they have enough. You don't need to rebuild. Use the turbo. And I was dreading getting on the phone. I was excited, but I was dreading getting on the phone to Jenkins and saying, normally aspirated Cosworth. We're going to run the turbo Ferrari. It never happened because Mr. Ferrari died, and once he died, the idea died with him, and so it never happened. So we went forward with the Cosworth, but I had the pleasure of meeting him twice, which was a rare, rare honour. I mean, fantastic.
Great story.
We talked for a long time about John Barnard and Maggie Thatcher. That's what we talked about. Yeah, he did, yes.
It was said, it's what Italy needs. Yes. Yeah,
he always said Barnard marched his men into battle as though they were troops.
Great story.
Not the John Barnard I knew, but anyway.
Well, it's a great story to end on, Mike, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure, thanks for having me.
Motorsport Magazine podcast. Have you still got the book? I guess you have. Ferrari book.
Yes, I have somewhere. I don't know exactly where it is.
It's better than a pension scheme, right?
Yeah, I'd never sell it. It means too much to me. I tell you what, Rob, I might leave it to you. I did only say might.
Okay. Nigel, would you anything you'd like to ask Mike before we close, seeing as you did describe the launch of the Onyx Formula One team is in the worst possible taste? Is there anything you'd like
Jesus,
to...
Jesus, your past comes back to...
Yes. It's a consequence of...
Well, all right, yes. All the drivers you've worked with, which driver A did you think was the best and which did you enjoy working with the most?
Probably enjoyed working with most was Pirro, because you can't help but enjoy yourself with Pirro. I mean, there's a host of stories about Pirro, but I probably can't tell them. But anyway, but probably the best driver, potentially, was Modena. I don't think anybody ever saw just how good he was. Yeah. We used to have a running gag in the thing. I used to think Prost was everything I had ever wanted to see in a driver. I thought he was fantastic. And from very early on, he said, oh, he will not live with Senna. He will not live with Senna. Senna is the man. He absolutely idolised Senna. And it, to a large extent, was mutual. As I say, when we were at Spa doing the 3000 race, we were on the downhill pits and they were up top. And he was walking down one night and he said, how did you do? I said, I think he's second. He said, all right. He's going to be very good when he gets to Formula One. He will be a threat. Yeah. And he rated him. And he was just so only driver I've ever seen when we were sort of, well, one more story. Sorry, you'll be here all day.
Okay.
We were at Vallelunga and we were normally in the top three or four of qualifying. And, ninth or tenth, and I said to him, right, okay, what's wrong? Well, I don't know. Maybe I drive today a little bit like my sister. I said, through the cutting at the back, are you flat? No. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I promise you, if the car's good and you've got new tyres on, that's flat. And he said, oh, okay. He went out with the tyres on, came in, dropped it on pole, came in. Flicked the visor up, I plugged in, because no ship to shore in those days, and I said, there you go, was it flat? And he said, yes, but only once. but if he believed you, he would do anything. He was uncanny in his understanding of what was going on in the car. He knew everything that was going on in the car. You could make very small changes, and he'd say, oh, that is not correct, check it again. And he was generally right.
And but I mean, he won the championship that year, and the March 87B wasn't the greatest car March produced, was it? A lot of other teams struggled with it. I know you got.
Yeah, we started with because we were the sort of semi works team. We started. I think they had 11 by the fourth race. There were our two. Mm. Everybody sold them.
Everyone had gone to Lola's or whatever. Yeah.
And we found a solution to what the problem was. It was offered to other people, but by then they didn't think it would work. And it was nothing very clever. It was just the way we packed the dampers, to be honest. Took the suspension out of it, effectively. But basically, it wasn't a great car. But he did a great job with it. You know, he was Birmingham was a good race for him. Yes, that was very good. Imola was the best because it was his home race. He was pretty special. And in answer to the question, I'd say the people I worked with, not necessarily at the top of the, I never saw him as good as he could have been. I'd have loved if Bernie had carried on and he'd been at Brabham's. Mm-hmm. I think he would have been a star. When he got to Tyrrell's and Jordan, both those teams, I mean, Eddie was playing with the Yamaha, I think, at the time, and Tyrrell were in a bad place, and so he never got the chance.
Great. Good. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but maybe we can persuade Michael to come back during the winter for part two, because there's many, 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 many more stories. And you know what? I just want to finish by saying one of the nice things about going to interview drivers from the past for Motorsport magazine is almost every one of them says, hey, how is Mike? You good? What's Mike doing?
It's and when's he going to pay me?
Yes, when's he?
No, I have to say, nearly every driver I've ever worked with, I've still got a Christmas card from, which is quite nice.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. Still a sport as well as a business, eh? Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. Great to have Mike Earle here today. And thanks to Simon Aaron, to Nigel Roebuck, and of course to Ed Foster, who makes all this possible for us, and to Alan Hyde, who records it all. It's goodbye from them and goodbye from me. See you next time.
Eu não posso, 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 eu não posso